Chapter 6, Deepening Conflict. A somewhat new stage in the movement away from the prospect of becoming a minister was reached in the early months of 1906. Prior to that time, the extraordinarily unsettling impact, especially of Hermann, had been disclosed. But now he is under compulsion to speak forth quite openly to his loved ones at home. An upsetting experience. His first specific intimation was in a letter written soon after the first of the year, addressed to Arthur, but evidently intended for the entire family. Regrettably, this letter has been lost, but other references are so frequent and detailed that one need not grieve over the loss overmuch. Arthur's response on January 21 discloses that his brother had been passing through a profoundly disturbing experience, occasioned not only by his doubts, but also by a deep sense of personal unworthiness to be a minister of Christ. The elder brother did not feel that he should urge him to enter the ministry, but warned him against losing perspective with regard to his faults. While it is possible that you may not exaggerate your own defects, it is certain that you underestimate those of others, that is, of others who occupy, and properly occupy, high positions in the church or in the world. His mother's first commentary, written the same day, speaks for itself. My dear boy, Arthur let me read your last letter to him, in which you speak of the impossibility of your entering the ministry. It would have been bad not to let me read the letter, as I would have imagined something dreadful, but he did not show it to the others. I want to assure you that, whatever you decide upon, I shall acquiesce in and do my best to help you in. You think that we would lose faith in you if we knew you perfectly. But one thing I can assure you of, that nothing that you could do could keep me from loving you. Nothing. It is easy enough to grieve me. Perhaps I worry too much. But my love for my boy is absolutely indestructible. Rely on that, whatever comes. And I have faith in you, too, and believe that the strength will come to you for your work, whatever it may be, and that the way will be opened. In the meantime, get all the good and all the fun, too, out of your present circumstances, and may God bless you and be with you. I am glad you went to Berlin and had a good time. On January 14, he had written to his father, though perhaps not in quite the same terms as to his brother, of his new frame of mind. In reply, he received an admonition, dated January 26, begging him not to be hasty in entering upon new plans. You know that I have always recognized your right not to feel precluded by anything in or connected with your past or present course of study from the final choice of a different profession, if you ever think it advisable, you yourself being the judge, to do so. None of the years of study you have had can ever be properly considered as wasted, no matter what field of work you may ultimately enter upon. You have had a mental training and have laid in store knowledge which are invaluable possessions. If the ministry be not felt to be your vocation, there is a whole realm of service of the most valuable sort, leaving that out of view. If you believe that to fit you for the higher walks in non-clerical learning, you would be better off for a year or more beyond this year in any special department, Greek in general, for instance, or some kindred study, you are quite young enough to pursue it, and prepared better by maturity of thought and a solid substructure than you would otherwise have been now to pursue it. The pecuniary question you need not bother about, I can assure you on that point. Life's work for a man is a great affair, and no amount of earnest preparation can be out of place at your age and in your circumstances. Nowadays, no student can well assume, like Bacon or Milton, to take all knowledge for his province. But breadth of vision is still a good thing, and freedom to study when there is so much to learn, and so many steps in the ascent have been cut out by the labors of zealous predecessors for the help of the modern student, is so gloriously exhilarating that you may well permit yourself to continue a student until you are ready to go to work to instruct and benefit mankind in the most effective way given to you. Meanwhile, in a letter of January 21st to his mother, he raised the question as to what he should do in March between terms, and indicated that he had been thinking of a trip to Rome. The alternative was to stay close to Marburg to do some reading. But then, reflecting that it was very difficult to pursue his studies without relating them to his future activity, he added, "If I were only convinced that it would ever be of any practical use to me, with what enthusiasm could I enter into the study of New Testament criticism? But how it can ever be of direct use to me, I do not see. Though it is only right to say that the benefit I have so far received from my half year in Europe for myself is almost boundless." 10 days later, he expressed himself in similar terms to his brother Arthur, though somewhat more bluntly, stating that he felt very much like a dilettante, carrying on his studies without relationship to worthy labor. He also reproached himself for having made a failure of things so far, and concluded, "But anything is better than the old hypocrisy, which even such an unhysterical person as yourself would fully admit as such if you knew the facts. For me to speak of the Christian ministry in one breath with myself is hypocrisy." The following day, in a letter to his mother, he reminds her that his seemingly rather abrupt negative decision concerning the ministry was not without a background in earlier attitudes. "Your sweet letter of January 21st arrived last night, and I hasten to drop a line in reply, though I haven't time to say much. I was grieved that Arlie did not show my letter, in which I spoke of the impossibility of entering the ministry, to Father, for I should have written it directly to him, and had him half in mind when I wrote. The truth was that when I sat down to write, I did not have much idea of what I was going to say. You probably think my decision or my present feeling about the matter is something new, but as a matter of fact, it is many years old. Only my blindness and the distance in the future of the decision have obscured things to me. I can't say I feel particularly different about it now, only that I see more clearly than before what a blessing it would be if I could get into some line of work where I could be certain I was doing right." His hesitation of entering Princeton Seminary, of which note has been taken above, confirms the basic correctness of this observation. And yet Machen probably did not mean to deny that, to a significant degree, his seemingly final decision had come with almost explosive suddenness. Though the same conclusion might have been reached in America if he had similarly been moved by the feeling that the hour of decision could no longer be postponed, one cannot doubt that the impact made by liberalism, especially in the person of Hermann, had precipitated it. Further reflections. 3 days later, on February 4th, regretful that he had not been careful to give his father the first intimation of his decision, he provides him with a more measured statement of his position. Having thanked him for the trouble he had taken in giving an account of the outcome of the burnt district case to satisfy his own curiosity, he wrote, "As I have indicated more or less plainly in several of my letters, it has seemed to me almost impossible even to think about going into the ministry, so that I am seriously considering what other possibilities may open themselves, as I now feel more and more keenly that the time has gone by when I can waste months and years in idleness or in aimless work. It is true that I cannot possibly look back upon the past year as wasted, as it has been a time of something more like progress than I have experienced at any other period of my life. Not that I underrate in the slightest the value of my home training, for without what I got from you and Mother, I should long since have given up all thoughts of religion or a moral life. And it is that training alone and the principles which have been instilled into me that enable me even now to employ my opportunities here in such a way as to make them real opportunities instead of pitfalls. Yet on the other hand, there is no doubt that, through my own fault, I had so poisoned my surroundings during the past few years, had gotten into such a rut that there seemed to be no chance of escape. I had so long kept up the form of piety and even engaged in active church work, when the whole thing was hypocrisy, that the things that are intended for moral and spiritual enlightenment had for me lost all their power. Perhaps not all, either, for I always at least had before me the ideal of a Christian life and the wish, weak though it was, to lead one. It is this ideal which now seems to stand me in good stead, the ideal of a real Christian faith and resulting Christian life. But you have no idea what a relief it was to me to be able, in a certain sense, to start out fresh, where my external relations had not been so connected with the habit of a false life. Don't misunderstand me by thinking I mean to say that I have now overcome the difficulties, or that I am now leading anything like what a Christian life ought to be, or even what an ordinary man regards as the ordinary morals of the world. But to say that this is not better than my life, for example, at the Hopkins, is ungrateful. At least, it is not so full of hypocrisy. At least I can begin with something more like honesty at the beginning. But for me to think about going into the ministry now would be simply to fall back into the old rut, and it is the partial escape from that makes me so intensely grateful to you for making it possible for me to come to Europe. Yet the only thing that enables me to get any benefit out of my opportunities here is the continual presence with me in spirit of you and Mother and the Christian teaching which you have given me. There follows a word of caution that his letters are not to be taken with absolute literalness. A caution, if felt necessary, in the case of the members of his family who would have had every advantage in detecting hyperbole or understatement as the case might be, that is doubly pertinent for interpreters who knew the man far less intimately or not at all. My experience when I write a letter about anything except commonplaces is usually that I regret either the whole or at least parts after I have put the letter in the box. All I can do, therefore, is to beg you not to take everything that I say too exactly. I am very much afraid of being misunderstood and of making a bad matter worse. Perhaps it would really be better to say nothing, as after all, I only can understand the circumstances. But in view of my future plans, it has become simply a necessity to let you know something of what has been passing in my mind. Don't think that all this is anything particularly new, for in my own more honest moments I have felt for years that it is practically impossible for me to enter the ministry. My idea is to go on and finish my year of study without thinking too much about the future, though that is mighty hard when I reflect that I am now 25 years old, unless, what would be the best thing of all, I can get directly into some line of work where I at least know that I am doing no harm. The difficulty is more deep-seated than you can ever understand, and I can only beg of you not to think you can understand it by drawing upon your own experience or that of the ordinary man. Such a procedure, little as you think it, could have only the effect of making me feel more keenly my isolation. He proceeds to tell of his reading in the New Testament field, and observes that the courses announced for the summer term at Marburg are so attractive that he is considering staying right there rather than going on to another university. Though a visit to Rome would be glorious, he thinks that he will probably remain in Marburg and work. And having mentioned a pleasant letter from Armstrong, he closes as follows. Give my love to all. Above all, don't think I am glad to break off from home. If I didn't have the remembrance of that home and of you all, and if I could not think of you all as still there and of my return, then indeed would I feel myself really in a foreign land. You can be sure that my affection for you all is rather increased than otherwise by my enforced absence. I only meant that I have been able better to put into practice what I learned, despite my faults, from you and mother and our Christian family. His mother on February 2nd, Arthur on the 4th, and his father on the 12th urged him to take advantage by all means of the opportunity of going to Rome. His mother's letter also told of a note received from Armstrong in which, having expressed his deep interest and strong affection for her son, he declares, "I have the fullest confidence in the ultimate issues of his studies. In whatever field he may choose to labor, I feel sure that his work will not only be useful, but brilliant." And Arthur reported that Dr. White of the Biblical Seminary of New York had been so impressed by Machen's articles on the virgin birth that he had told Mr. Kirk that he wanted to get him for his staff, but that Patton had said that "you are wanted at Princeton," that indeed you are the one man they want. His father's letter may advantageously be quoted at greater length. "I think your Easter vacation would be well applied to an excursion to Rome. A visit to Rome is part of a liberal education, and no opportunity of making it should be neglected. Unless, therefore, you feel very strongly drawn in some different direction, I should certainly go if I were you. Your letter to your mother, your late one, has been received. Arthur's letter was not kept from me, as you may already have gathered from the tenor of my last to you. I have entire confidence that you will ultimately settle into some walk of life which will satisfy both your taste and your conscience, and whatever choice of profession you do make, I shall believe it to be the best one for you. Meanwhile, do not feel obliged to hurry your choice, either the choice or the entering upon the field chosen." In other paragraphs, he sought to persuade his son to abandon his deprecatory attitude toward his review articles on the virgin birth, and speaks of his critical interest in Ulliker. "Your article, you may depend on it, whatever criticism you may yourself be disposed to indulge in, is a good one, strong and in every sense good and bound to do good. It is sure to command respect even in quarters not predisposed in favor of the argument. You make a great mistake in undervaluing it. You had to deal with a difficult and complex problem and have handled it fairly to all sides, and most clearly and convincingly. I have been reading your Professor Ulliker's Introduction to the New Testament in the English translation of Mrs. or Miss Janet Penrose Ward with great interest. There is so much that is attractive in manner and spirit, so much acute and just criticism, that I feel rewarded, notwithstanding the strange departures from sound reasoning manifested in many places. I suppose what is at the bottom of the error of the school of philosophy to which he, like so many more of the modern higher critics, belongs, is the assumption that the miraculous is impossible, even if accompanying a divine revelation, and therefore, per se, incredible. A kindred fallacy is the dogma that a solid theory of a future life can be evolved from the phenomena discernible by the senses and cognizable by human science alone. In several further letters from home during the month of February, he continued to be warmly urged to avail himself of the opportunity of visiting Rome. And one might have predicted that such hearty commendation of his expressed desire to see Rome would have served to overcome his hesitation, especially since he might well have argued that such a glorious adventure, with a complete change of scene, would perhaps relieve his mind of its present turmoil. That he did not undertake this journey provides, therefore, another evidence that, however overwhelmed he was at times by the problems that beset him in Germany, he was of sturdier fiber than to adopt the tempting solution of escape from his environment. As he states in a letter of February 18th, he had gotten a little bit settled down to do some earnest reading. Moreover, about this time or a little later, he made a definite decision to follow up his work at Marburg with a term at Göttingen. The interval between terms did indeed permit brief interludes of travel and relaxation. One journey of about a week included stops in Frankfurt, Darmstadt, Worms, Speyer, Mannheim, Heidelberg, Strasbourg, and Freiburg. Heidelberg particularly he found entrancing. Writing to his mother on March 25th, after his return to Marburg, he dwells on a memorable view of the town. After sunset, on the terrace near the castle, I spent the hour, which was worth almost as much as all the rest of the trip put together. Like the Rhine, and unlike the high mountains, the charm of Heidelberg does not force itself upon you, but is only to be caught at the proper time and place. But that evening hour was one which I shall never forget. The gathering gloom seemed to hide from view everything prosaic and commonplace, while the distance above the town made all sounds indistinguishable except a dull murmur of life and the rushing of the river just before it lost itself in a blaze of gold in the boundless plain. It seems as though the town were the last stopping place at the boundary of another world, where travelers bid a last farewell to human life just before entering upon the plains whose glories are too mysterious for earthly eyes. Later, there was a hurried trip to Göttingen to secure lodging for the coming term, and still later, just before settling in Göttingen on April 19th, a few days featured by a little relaxation in Wernigerode and a delightful walk in the Harz Mountains from the vicinity of Quedlinburg. During a very large part of this period, however, he remained at Marburg, largely occupied with the study of the New Testament. That it was not a time of serenity, free from the necessity of struggling with the pressing questions of his future work, is, however, plain. Perhaps, indeed, he was not much perplexed by an invitation which reached him in February to consider the possibility of joining the staff of Dr. White's Bible School in New York. Though he felt complimented by the offer, which, as reported above, had as its immediate background Dr. White's admiration of Machen's articles in the Princeton Review, he felt that, if he were to engage in religious work at all, he would be much better suited for the type of post that Armstrong and Patton had had in view. Work on the university level was his real ideal, and the devotional atmosphere of the seminary was more congenial. Hence, he declined the offer, apparently without delay. Approach on behalf of Princeton. But only a few weeks later, he was compelled to face the question whether that which appeared preferable was really practicable. For on March 11th, Professor Armstrong wrote the following. And now, Doss, What do you think about coming to Princeton in the fall? I should be greatly gratified if I could present your name to the board of directors at their meeting on May 7th and have them appoint you instructor in the New Testament department. If, however, you do not feel ready to decide the question now, I can and will gladly wait until you come back and we can talk the matter over. The appointment could, of course, be made at the fall meeting of the directors on October 9th, in time for you to take up the work of the year. Should you be inclined, after consideration, to think favorably of coming, and I hope you will, you need have no hesitancy for fear of binding yourself for more than the 1 year, and for this there would be no necessity of ordination. The very terms of the letter show that this offer was not regarded as essentially new. Moreover, Dr. Armstrong suggests that he was not overly hopeful of securing an affirmative reply, though he seeks to overcome, so far as possible, Machen's scruples. Strangely, one looks in vain in the letters of the following period for mention of Armstrong's letter, though from later developments we learn that, while he was still in Marburg, he had written that he was not prepared to accept the invitation. How far he was from reaching solid ground is indicated, however, by the following comment to his father on March 30th. How I envy every humble clerk who at least has some employment in which he can engage with enthusiasm without doubts and qualms of conscience. If there were the slightest chance of my getting anything of a start in business life, even at this late day, it would be like a ray of hope. So do I dread the 3 or 4 years of preparation required now to fit me for anything else, even supposing I had any particular bent toward one of the learned professions. Just now my enthusiasm is waning even for the historical study of the New Testament. And without enthusiasm and a broad, free way of looking at things, it is worse than useless to approach that study of all others. His brother Arthur, whose frequent letters disclose his loving concern to overcome every difficulty, at one point argued that, though he might not feel able to undertake the peculiar demands made upon the preacher, he might more readily enter upon the work of a teacher of the New Testament, for which the one qualification par excellence is sane scholarship. Evidently, in reply to this effort to preserve his brother's interest in distinctly Christian work, the younger brother replied on the eve of taking up his work at Göttingen, "In the field of New Testament, there is no place for the weakling. Decisiveness, moral and intellectual, is absolutely required. Any other kind of work is not merely useless. It might even be humbly useful in other fields, but it is even perhaps harmful." As things turned out, Machen was to be influenced eventually by the consideration that his going to Princeton would not necessarily involve a positive decision to become an ordained minister. Nevertheless, his negative answer to Armstrong and his strong words to his brother concerning the qualifications of a seminary teacher are remarkably revealing, for they show that Machen was not weakly grasping for a way out of his apparent impasse, and that he was profoundly aware that a dualism between the intellectual and spiritual was untenable. Theoretically, it might be possible to contemplate an instructorship in the seminary in isolation from decisions as to the more ultimate questions of faith and calling. But practically, he realized that such a solution was at best a brief postponement of the inevitable. At Göttingen. When Machen entered upon his life at Göttingen toward the end of April 1906, he was not enjoying his first contact with this ancient town or its university, established in 1737. For, as it will be recalled, he had gone there in 1904, armed with a letter of introduction from Gildersleeve, the Göttingen alumnus of half a century, and had spent a number of enjoyable days there. His contacts had been with the philologians rather than with the professors or students of theology, And so academically, his life and work there in 1906 constituted a fresh experience. His choice of Göttingen had not been easily reached, partly because he was reluctant to wrench himself loose from the congenial Kummels and Links in Marburg. On the whole, however, it seemed wise to come into contact with other scholars in his field. And Göttingen, like Marburg, and in distinction from others like Berlin and Halle, did not have the disadvantages of a big city, and yet was a great center of New Testament investigation as of learning in general. The variety of courses that were open to him is indicated by an early letter in which he reports, "I have been listening to Schurer on exegesis of Matthew, Bousset on Galatians, Bonvetsch on Apostolic Age, and last but not least, Heitmüller on the Gospel of John. Also, I shall be a listener at Schurer's seminar on the Pastoral Epistles, shall hear Bousset once a week on Jesus and Paulus, and then I shall probably hear Kattenbusch on the history of Protestant theology since the Aufklärung. I heard the famous Wellhausen once on the ancient Arabs and Islam, but shall probably not take the course, and probably it would be mighty interesting, but I haven't time for things that lie far afield." Though none of these men possessed the personal magnetism of Hermann, and perhaps not of Ulliker, they were all of distinguished ability, and either had gained a high reputation because of their scholarly productions, or were soon to do so. Schurer, the head of the New Testament department, was known especially for his monumental and massive work on the history of the Jewish people in the time of Jesus Christ, a work which remains today an outstanding contribution to the history of the beginnings of the Christian era. Machen's reactions to his teaching, formulated somewhat over a month after the beginning of the term, were as follows. "Though his method of lecturing is somewhat dry, and is not of a sort to inspire anyone who has not already an interest in the subject, yet I am learning a good deal from his careful exegesis of Matthew, which he carries on 5 times a week. Indeed, even his manner of speaking, after you get used to it, has an excellence of its own, for it seems to reflect the peculiar solidity and minuteness of his learning. His conduct of the seminar on the pastoral epistles pleases me less, since he has no conversational faculty and no power of starting an interesting discussion among the members of the class. The papers read in the seminar are also of a very much lower order than would be expected at the Hopkins, for example. But this is perhaps chiefly due to the fact that only a week is allowed each student for the preparation and to the inadequate library facilities. As to his critical views of the New Testament, I do not believe Schurer differs in essentials from the type that you have learned to know in Ulliker." Wilhelm Bousset, who was then about 40, was a subordinate in the department, but possessed far greater popular gifts, and was remembered as a brilliant lecturer. In 1892, he had published a little book on the preaching of Jesus, which was rather typically liberal. But about 1900, he became an exponent, along with Hermann Gunkel in the Old Testament field, Religionsgeschichtliche Methode, which for want of more felicitous rendering may perhaps best be called the History of Religion's Method. Bousset's important volume on Judaism, 1903, his commentary on Revelation, 1906, and other works, including especially his brilliant and sensational Kurios Christos, 1913, are significant exhibitions of the development of an approach which, while somewhat weakening the hold of the older liberalism, spelled the dawn of a more radical era in the history of New Testament criticism. To expound and to evaluate this new method would take us beyond the scope of this biography, though mention may be made of Machen's estimate and criticism of Bousset in his Sprint lectures some 15 years later, published as The Origin of Paul's Religion. Our present purpose may be served, however, if we quote from Machen's popular summary written for the benefit of his brother Arthur, observing that nearly all modern investigators are more or less affected by the method, but that certain ones have made it their special task to justify and extend its use, he said, "The general aim is better to understand the Christian religion by exhibiting it, in its beginnings as well as in its later dogmatic form, in its relations to other religions, and by pointing out the influence which other religions have had upon its origin and later history. The idea is that only when we understand the New Testament in its historical relations shall we be able fully to appreciate it. It is admitted that the personality of Jesus, like every great personality, introduces an element which it is useless to attempt to explain. But Jesus had a place in history, and the form of his teaching and work was conditioned by that place in the evolution of humanity. The work of the scholar is to trace the lines of connection between peoples and between religions which gave that evolution unity. These connections are not to be sought now chiefly by pointing out literary dependence or by investigating the thought of the theologians or of the learned men of ancient times. Such was the old method. The new method takes as the especial object of investigation the religion, the superstitions, the legends of the masses of the people, and finds that in this hidden sphere the various nations exhibit close relationships that do not so clearly appear in their philosophies, theologies, and in general in the thought of the educated. But again and again, the popular representations crop out even in the writings of the most enlightened, as for example in the writings of Paul and elsewhere in the New Testament. The tenacity with which ancient customs and legends were handed down among the common people is particularly emphasized, so that it often happens that we find the more ancient form of a myth in a writing which is far later than one that now contains a far more developed form of the myth. From one point of view, the Religion Geschichtliche Methode is a revolt against purely literary criticism. Account was taken further of the gradual rise of the method and of its leading representatives, and then speaking more particularly of Bossuet's effort to popularize the modern theology with the aim of liberating Christianity of its load of dead form, that the gospel might once more ring out with its old power, Machen commented, "The aim is a noble one, but it may well be doubted whether it is being attained. What Bossuet has left after he has stripped off the form is certainly well worth keeping, but whether it is the Christian faith that has been found to overcome the world is very doubtful. His fight against orthodoxy has made Bossuet a very prominent man in German public life, and he is certainly also brilliant as an investigator, but he lacks the caution of men like Schurer or Ulliker." Wilhelm Heitmüller was a young man who had only recently become associated with the university staff and was only a private docent, but had already gained a considerable reputation as a scholar and author. His general position was similar to Bossuet's, but Machen found him superior to Bossuet in some respects. "He strikes me as being less passionate and less of a party man than Bossuet, and hence perhaps more cautious as a scholar, though I do not know that his critical results are less radical in the main points. At any rate, his exegesis of the fourth gospel is probably the best course I have, as he displays a great appreciation for the religious worth of the book, and tact and good sense in the exegesis. Of course, his opinion of the direct historical value of the gospel is very low." Bonvetsch he described as conservative, but added that the conservative view of the New Testament is not so well represented at Göttingen as by Armstrong at Princeton. And apropos of the fact that his brother had expressed wonder that, In view of his orthodoxy or conservatism, Zahn had apparently not been recommended as one under whom he should study. Machen, while recognizing the prodigious learning of Zahn, made the point that it is a mistake, I think, to suppose that any of the Princeton faculty would be inclined to advise a student in my circumstances to seek out a conservative university just because it is conservative. For Princeton Seminary differs from some other conservative institutions in that it does not hide from itself the real state of affairs in biblical study at the present day, and makes an honest effort to come to an understanding with the ruling tendency. Summing up, while warning that his generalizations concerning the professors at Göttingen should not be taken too seriously, he spoke of the inspiration of residing at one of the greatest centers of learning in the world, and declared that a stay at a place like this is enough to make a man humble at any rate, and I see plainly that there is a lot to be done before I could accomplish anything in academic life. Member of the Germania. Although accordingly the academic work at Göttingen, while satisfying in many respects, lacks the luster of his studies at Marburg, there was another aspect of university life that proved far more exhilarating. For to his great delight, Machen became an associate member of one of the student societies, not merely as a hospitant, as at Marburg, but as a Konknepant. The name Burschenschaft, as distinguished from Verbindung, was usually reserved for the regulation duel-fighting clubs, but this society, like the Franconia Verbindung, was more moderate than most in this and other respects. Nevertheless, Machen once stated that the temperance principle seems to be essentially that nobody is compelled to drink more beer than he chooses, a quite different principle from that prevailing in the regular corps and Burschenschaften. The Burschenschaften, as also the motto of the Germania, Gott, Freiheit, Vaterland, suggests, had a patriotic motif, and they on occasion had been of no little political significance, but under ordinary circumstances they had an exclusively social function. His new life as one of the Germanen with the sacred couleur gave Machen a sense of belonging, which was impossible for one who was treated as a guest with the formality and politeness customary between host and guest. Now he was addressed as Du, and had the right and duty so to address all other members. The change from Sie to Du, he explained, was incomprehensible unless there was a feeling for the German language and German life. Actually, it meant a change in the entire atmosphere of one's life, signifying a sudden change from distant acquaintanceship to at least incipient friendship. Likewise, wearing the couleur and fulfilling the meticulous rules of conduct and manners would seem artificial and even ridiculous to an American. But here on its historical ground, indissolubly connected with German student life, Machen wrote home, it does not impress me at all that way. Indeed, I am as proud as a dog with two tails. The gymnastics and fencing indulged in by the students were rather beyond him, though he took a few lessons in the latter. But when it came to tennis, it was a great relief to be regarded as an expert at the game. Though Machen entered rather fully into the social life of the society, membership was not without producing its own questions of conscience. The German Sunday being what it was, there were excursions in which he did not take part. This posed no special discomfort, since he had taken pains to indicate to the society, before being accepted, that his views concerning it were not of their own. A more serious problem seemed to arise, however, in connection with his attendance upon services in a Baptist church. On July 9th, he wrote his mother, "Things have been going by no means as smoothly with me during the past week as they did formerly. It seems that there is a disposition on the part of the Germania to think that the Baptist congregation, in which I want to come into contact with some real live religion in order to supplement the comparative deadness of the regular Lutheran Church, is unkulturfähig, i.e., cannot be visited in Kulair. I believe in adapting myself to the customs of the country as far as possible, but I must say it makes me shaky to be obliged to go, as it were, in disguise when I want to engage in worship with real disciples of Christ. It makes me feel as though I were a traitor to a more sacred Kulair than that of the Germania, and that if the two come into conflict, the latter ought to give place. However, I have heard no real decision about the thing, and in any case shall go slow about anything I do, but my pleasure has for the present been destroyed. The Germans are very tolerant about little questions, like the person of Christ, but when it comes to the outward form of religion, they are more intolerant than the most bigoted of the Orthodox. A week later, however, he said that his gloomy remark should not be taken too seriously, and that the troubles that he had thought confronted him did not seem to be showing up. Perhaps merely isolated comments had been made, and these had subsided. Soon thereafter, he seemed to be enjoying the social life immensely, and spoke of the Germania as a second Benham. And he even read a paper prepared in German on the universities of the United States, which was later published in the national organ of the Burschenschaft, a paper which he described as a caution to cats. But it afforded more self-respect now that I at least have made an attempt to write some German. New doubts rose, however, as to whether he should justify indefinite continuance of his membership in the society, because he began to feel that in practice they appeared to take a position against the Orthodox or Conservative Party. In his uncertainty as to where things actually stood, he was determined to ask Dr. Heitmüller, an active alumnus, for an explanation. In this connection, he writes, however, that he does not believe in combating religious errors by any outward means, such as trying to prevent the propagation of such ideas. And then, in a rare disclosure of actual doubt, and in what may well have been the mood of the moment rather than expressive of his most basic convictions, he adds, "Nor am I by any means certain where the truth lies. Probably it is something that none of us at present sees, but that Bousset and Heitmüller have gotten hold of it is something that I should be sorry to think." The talk with Heitmüller materialized within a few days, and he was rather reassured as to his right to remain in the society, for he was told that even now, despite the tendency of recent years, the number of alumni of the Germania who favor my way of thinking is greater than those who agree with him. So that, Machen concluded, there can hardly be anything in the constitution of the Germania that would prevent its being subscribed even by so orthodox a person as your humble servant. The conference was also memorable because it was not confined to the narrower question of membership in the Germania. It concerned also the religious importance of the difference between the so-called modern theology and the Orthodox theology. Machen, taking the position against Heitmüller that the difference affected the very essence of Christianity. He added, however, in reporting the matter to his mother, that the earnest religious life of those who do not hold our view of the person of Christ in Germany and their earnest desire not to break with the Christian Church are at least grounds for the utmost caution in our manner of opposing them. It appears again, therefore, in spite of the intense and painful struggle through which he went, and though there were times of agonizing doubt, that when an issue affecting the Christian faith and life arose, he stood for rather than against Orthodox Christianity. Much time was to pass before the issue between Christianity and modernism was to be fully crystallized in his mind, and his hesitation as to where the truth lay had completely disappeared. But as one who had gone through a severe and continued struggle, he never minimized the reality and the deadly seriousness of the battle in which others were engaged. And as one who finally found victory and tranquility of spirit because of the profound and constant sympathy of others, he was, as all those who really knew him discovered, a man of extraordinary compassion toward those who were passing through difficulties such as he, from experience, knew only too well.